This is an ABC podcast.
The United States hasn't adapted to the new rules of war, and this is why they haven't won a single war in the past 70 years. That's the thesis of Sean McFate, Professor of Strategy at the National Defence University and Georgetown University. He served as a paratrooper and officer in the US Army and worked as a military contractor. When it comes to strategy, McFate believes the US got it all wrong.
Warfare has changed, but we have not. Our adversaries grasp this, and that's why they prevail. Durable disorder is the new global environment. It is replacing, as the Westphalian order of nation states retreats, it is what's left in the wake. Now, it's not anarchy, but it is a world where conflicts do not resolve. They persist and smolder eternally in so-called forever wars. And it's marked by permanent entropy and overlapping forms of governance, if any governance at all. Now, those who grasp the changing global environment of durable disorder can exploit it and do. And those who do not are being exploited. Unfortunately, American foreign policy is the Humpty Dumpty foreign policy. It's about trying to put the international order as we imagined it back together, reestablishing a liberal world order. But you cannot do this. A new kind of world order begets a new type of warfare. It's getting sneakier. War is becoming epistemological. Telling truth from lies determines winners and losers, not Waterloo or Gettysburg or Stalingrad or Midway. We're still investing in the old rules of war of battlefield victory. War has moved past battlefield victory.
This is Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. The strategies of conventional war, such as the two world wars, no longer apply to the modern world, a world defined by durable disorder. This period of unrest is created by numerous factors: China's rise, Russia's resurgence, America's retreat, global terrorism, international criminal empires, climate change, dwindling natural resources, and bloody civil wars. And it's China, Russia, and terror organizations that have best adapted to these new conditions, not the US armed forces. This is the biggest threat the world faces today. So believes Sean McFate.
I wrote this book because I was angry. I was angry because, maybe like you, I have lost friends in Iraq and Afghanistan. As a taxpayer, it has sickened me to see trillions of dollars sort of thrown away in Iraq, Afghanistan, other places. As a vet, it hurts me to see our national image tarnished by low-level foes, all while achieving very little on the ground. And I wanted to know, because we do have the very best military in the world. We have the best troops, the best training, the very best technology, the most money. The U.S. Department of Defense has more money than all the next eight biggest militaries in the world combined. Combined. Yet we haven't won a war since 45. The last time we won a war, the world ran on vacuum tubes. So I wanted to know, what's the problem? And that's the central puzzle of this book, which is written, by the way, for everybody. It's not an academic-y book. It's written so that my mother could read it. So I want to have a debate and discussion beyond the Beltway and beyond sort of academic and expert circles. So here's the bottom line up front, is that warfare has changed, but we have not. Our adversaries grasp this, and that's why they prevail. We must change too. And at the end of the book, this book explains how to do that. It doesn't just identify a problem, but it gives solutions, specific solutions. And it's causing a bit of a stir right now in the national security establishment. So the problem is this, is that victorious nations are loath to change the way they fight war. Let's go back 100 years, way back to World War I. Billy Mitchell, an American aviator in World War I. This man, he saw the future of war and it was air power. And when he came back to Washington, D.C., he said to everybody, air power is the future. But of course, England, France, America was like, no, it's going to be infantry. It's going to be static line, trench warfare. It's going to be basically the Maginot Line. And he said, no, it's going to be air power. And to demonstrate this, he said, I can sink battleships, which back then in the 20s was anathema. Basically, an airplane was a motorized kite in the era of the super dreadnought. They drug out some captured German battleships from World War I into the Chesapeake and dropped bombs on them and sunk a few. But it became a huge uproar in the press, saying it's a circus show, it's not real, etc. And perhaps to get Billy Mitchell out of the media spotlight, the head brass in the War Department sent Mitchell on a one-year inspection cruise of the Pacific Ocean, just to get him out of town. You know, just go away, Billy. Just be quiet for your own good. Well, Billy Mitchell comes back a year later with like a 400-page type report saying, in the future, Japan will launch a sneak attack against Pearl Harbor at 7:30 in the morning on a Sunday with aviation. He said this in 1924. Now, what do you think happened? Now, ask, what do you think the military did with Billy Mitchell? They saw they court-martialed him for this. That's right, they court-martialed him in a very public, like Kardashian court-martial. It was ugly. It was demeaning. It was horrible. The press was there. It was at Washington, D.C., at Fort Leslie McNair. They defrocked him, and he quit. He said, I'm done. And he, for the next couple years, proselytized air power to anybody who would listen to him. He died a bitter man in Milwaukee. And then a few years later, Pearl Harbor happened. And the U.S. military said it was caught completely by surprise, even though they had early warning from 1924. Now, it has a sort of a happy ending. The military, in its way, made up and apologized to Billy Mitchell. In its way, they named a bomber after him. The B-25 Mitchell bomber, the only one in World War II actually named after a person. The moral of this story is that victorious nations do not like to change the way they win wars, even at their own demise. France thought the future of war will be just like past wars, World War I, it'll be static trench line defenses. So they built the best defense line in the world, the Maginot Line. Meanwhile, Germany had innovated, because it was hungry, and it created the Blitzkrieg. Actually an English idea, and went right around the Maginot Line. We are facing a Billy Mitchell moment today. That's what this book tries to explain and tries to answer. And the stakes are high, because even an undefeated army can lose a war. Rome thought itself the eternal city until 410 AD. So if we were asked today, what are today's biggest threats? We could spend all night, which we will not do, doing so, discussing this. You could say China, Russia, those are the threats du jour. It could be Iran, nuclear missile program. It could be ISIS 3.0. It could be narcotic wars in the south of our border. It could be Venezuela right now, genocide, North Korea, climate change, etc. And as all these are bad threats, they are not the worst. They are not the worst. Something that's giving rise to all of them is a systemic threat that I call durable disorder. Durable disorder is the new global environment. It's slowly creeping around the world and has been at least for 25 years. It is replacing, as the Westphalian order of nation states retreats, it is what's left in the wake. Now, it's not anarchy. Well, first of all, it contains and does not solve problems, which is the problem. But it's not anarchy. It's not the sky is falling, let's invest in more sky. But it is a world where conflicts do not resolve. They persist and smolder eternally in so-called forever wars. And it's marked by permanent entropy and overlapping forms of governance, if any governance at all. It is systemic. That gives rise to the other threats we've discussed. Others are even exploiting it, like I would say Russia and others. It is also not new. Most of the history of the world is disordered. This notion that we learn in sixth grade that the world is run by nation states and only they get to wage war with their national armies, that is largely a fiction. It's ahistorical. It's only a couple hundred years old. Most of the world looks like durable disorder. This is the world that Machiavelli was lamenting about in The Prince. If you look at, for example, the Middle Ages or early Renaissance, it looks very similar to today. The Middle East looks very much like this, where you had, you know, anybody who was rich enough could wage war for any reason they wanted to. There were groups of, like, whether they would be sort of religious zealots or mercenaries or whatever. And what this meant was there was persistent, never-ending conflict. And we were returning to the status quo ante of durable disorder. Signs of it today. It's been going on at least since the end of the Cold War, but half of all peace deals fail in 5 years. Over half the world states are in some form of armed conflict. The majority of countries around the world are failed or failing by any metric. Many states are just regimes in states rather than actual states. Armed conflicts persist. They don't resolve today. We are seeing the return of mercenaries for the first time in 150 years. They went underground, but now they're coming back. And now that you have mercenaries, and these are not just the lone guys in the Congolese jungles with a Kalashnikov, these are high-end special operations units. These are showing up with attack helicopters. Now that you have mercenaries, anybody who's rich enough can wage war for whatever reason they want, no matter how petty. The super rich can become a superpower, for good or for bad. I mean, a good example might be if there's another ISIS, you know, outbreak in northern Iraq, and they start crucifying Christian men and selling Christian women off to sexual slave markets, and the international community doesn't do anything like it really didn't do before. Can you imagine a megachurch with a $90 million annual budget hiring mercenaries to go out there and protect Christians? Yes, one can. And we can talk about something. I was involved in something similar to that 10 years ago. So this is, you know, those who grasp the changing global environment of durable disorder can exploit it and do. And those who do not are being exploited. Unfortunately, American foreign policy is the Humpty Dumpty foreign policy. It's about trying to put the international order as we imagined it back together, reestablishing a liberal world order. Now, whether that liberal world order really existed as they think it does is a different question, but you cannot do this. We are going back, the proverbial horse has fled the barn. So a new kind of world order begets a new type of warfare. Last year, the national defense strategy shifted. The national defense strategy is, there's a national security strategy, and under that is a national defense strategy, and it orients our military about how to fight future wars, what the threat is, and it made a major shift last year. It shifted from counterterrorism, counterinsurgency against near peer threats, big power threats. And it talks about disorder as a part of this. And specifically, the big power threats that we're focusing on now are China and Russia. Here's the issue. Everybody thinks that if there's going to be a big fight with China or Russia, that'll be just like World War II. It'll be conventional. There's a saying that generals always fight the last war. Perhaps you've heard of it, or the last successful war. Well, this truism happens to be true. And for us, the last big successful war was World War II. And if you ask people in Washington, D.C., in think tanks or Hollywood, you know, to imagine the future of war, usually it's some version of World War II with better technology. That's usually what they imagine. But why does everybody assume that if there's a fight with China or Russia in the future, it'll be a conventional one, like World War II? It won't. Conventional war is dead. And this is actually rule number one of my 10 new rules of war. Conventional war is dead. Data clearly shows in social science that there's nothing more unconventional today than a conventional war. This is from 1946 to 2015. Nobody fights conventionally except for us anymore. Yet we're sinking a big bulk, perhaps the majority of our defense dollars, into preparing for another conventional war, which is the very definition of insanity. In fact, you could already argue we are at war with China and Russia right now, And part of their strategy is to keep us from knowing that, to keep us guessing. So what does war look like in durable disorder? A new type of global environment, a new type of conflict. It's getting sneakier. It is getting sneakier. War is getting sneaky. So let's look at the Crimea. Old rules versus new rules. In the old rules of war, when the Soviet Union wanted to, you know, take or reestablish control over a territory, they would use armored columns and tanks. Think of Hungary, 56, the Czechoslovakia, 68. They could blitzkrieg through eastern Ukraine. They had the military to do so compared to Ukraine, but they didn't do that. What they used instead, new rules of war, are special forces, Spetsnaz, mercenaries like the Wagner Group, sort of fake pro-separatist militias like the Donbass Battalion, Russian soldiers, you know, wearing uniforms with no insignia. And so those little green men that little kids play with, those little toy soldiers, and they used a lot of propaganda and information warfare. They occupied eastern Ukraine and Crimea with a ghost occupation. And the reason this worked is because we live in a global information age where plausible deniability is more powerful than firepower. Kremlin gets that, we do not, right? They actually cut their defense budget like a year ago, yet their, you know, bellicosity has not been cut at all. So by the time the West was still figuring out what was going on, Crimea was a fait accompli, victory. That's new rules of war. How about this? The South China Sea. China is taking over the South China Sea. Everything we're doing is not working. Old rules of war, they would require carriers. We'd throw in carriers as a deterrent, and they would back down. Now, we throw in carriers and the Navy into the South China Sea. It does not stop China at all. But what do? More carriers, more early Brooke destroyers. The reason that their strategy is working is it goes something like this. This is one of the rules of the new rules of war. We think of war and peace like pregnancy. You either are or you are not. And that's wrong. It's not war or peace, it's war and peace. Okay? Think of the Cold War, right? Think of war and peace like a light switch. It's either on or off. And so their strategy, China's strategy, is to keep the superpower's light switch switched to off so that we remain docile. And as long as we are docile, they can get away with murder, and they do. So war and peace is a false dichotomy. It's a fiction in our head. They exploit that fiction. They get right in between that space of war and peace. They go right up to the brink of war in the South China Sea, right up to where we will react, and they stop. But they keep everything they capture or create. And this is how they're winning the South China Sea, one island at a time, without carrier groups. And we're still fighting old rules of war by throwing in more carrier groups. Or mercenaries. So mercenaries are all over the world now. It's the biggest insecurity trend of the 21st century, in the early part, that is totally not covered, and that's by design. These mercenaries offer maximum plausible deniability. And I have a background in this world, and it's scarier than most people think. When you want something positively done in war and don't want your name attached to it, you hire mercenaries. And these are special operators. They're active in Ukraine, Syria, Iraq, Yemen, Nigeria, Somalia, parts of the Congo. They're in Venezuela right now. Russia sent the Wagner Group into Venezuela. Russia's backing Maduro. And they know that if the military leaves Maduro and joins the Guaido, then Venezuela is lost to Russian influence. So they sent in the Wagner Group to kneecap the Venezuelan military, to be enforcers, saying you will not defect. That's new rules of war. So in the future, victory goes to the cunning and not the strong, yet the United States, for example, is still investing in the strong, and we wonder why we lose. We are not set up currently to fight in this environment. In fact, our habits, our systems, our bureaucracies refuse to even recognize this reality or adapt to it. We buy, train, equip, all these things for an old set of rules of war, and then we get frustrated by the results. That is the problem. This is what I call strategic atrophy. And this answers the very first question I put up. So we have the best military. There's no question about it. We have the best of everything beyond the military. The problem is we have a low strategic IQ about how to deploy it. We have a low strategic atrophy. I like to say that budgets are moral documents because they do not lie. If you look at where we're putting our money, it's into things like technology, machines. So here's an example of a robot by Boston Dynamics. And we're investing all sorts of money into robots, thinking that in the future will be robot wars. So instead of D-Day, when the landing rampart goes down, having American troops come out, you'll have, robots come out. I don't really know. What's the purpose of this? How about this? This is a system that's being developed by the Department of Defense, and it's like a visor that you wear that sort of shows everything on the tactical battlefield, your friend, your foe. You could do collaborative targeting. It's really just like Xbox, but in real life. And my favorite is the F-35. Now, this is a fighter plane. You've heard of it, probably. We being U.S. taxpayers, have spent on this program $1.5 trillion. Okay, we've spent more money than Russia's GDP. Think about that. Now, in two long wars, how many combat missions has this thing racked up? Zero. Zero combat missions. Now, I'm an old infantry guy. I'm an old paratrooper. And the worth of any weapon is its utility. Now, we're buying more of these things. Now, in the South, I grew up in the North. In the South, we'd say, this dog don't hunt, right? We're buying more of these things. And they don't go to war. It's as useless as the battleship in 1939. It's as useless as the battleship in 1939. Now, let's look about war in reality, okay? And what does work. Also, all those things were about achieving tactical, this is the military term, tactical combat overmatch. Combat overmatch. That means battlefield victory. But battlefield victory is irrelevant in the new rules of war. Victory is elsewhere, and we'll talk about this, but war is becoming epistemological. Telling truth from lies determines winners and losers, not Waterloo or Gettysburg or Stalingrad or Midway. We're still investing in the old rules of war of battlefield victory. War has moved past battlefield victory. Here's an example. Strategic victory, not tactical. Russia interfering with elections. Not just 2016, but also the Brexit across Europe. There's general consensus in this country that from all the intelligence agencies that Russia tried to interfere in 2016, maybe 18, maybe 20. The only question remains is how successful were they? Was it a trifling success? Did it sway the election? That's TBD. But the strategic logic of messing with elections is this. Who cares about the sword if you can manipulate the arm that wields it? This is how you win in modern warfare. It's not with tanks, it's with ballot boxes. Or this. In the old rules of war, the Soviet Union wanted to disunite Europe. That was always the goal. Disunite NATO, disunite the EU, break apart Europe. And what they would do is they would use the old rules of war. They would threaten violent force. They would have these huge military exercises on the border of East-West Germany, 150,000 soldiers, Zapad 81. And they'd tell NATO, don't worry, it's just a military exercise. Don't get worked up. But of course, NATO has no idea if that's is it a feint or is it just an exercise? And so it'd freak NATO out. Now, that's old rules. New rules of war. When Russia wants to disunite Europe, it bombs civilian centers in Syria. That creates a tidal wave of refugees that crashes on the shores of the EU and creates the Brexit. It creates the rise of right-wing national parties that then want to break apart the EU. New rules of war, Russia is weaponizing refugees. How about Hollywood? When was the last time anybody saw a villain in a Hollywood movie that was Chinese? Anybody? You can't. Hollywood has been bought by China. They greenlit everything. So in a world that's becoming more and more about narrative and the war of narrative, they own the biggest megaphone in the world. And they're rumored to be making their own version of Hollywood to surpass the United States' Hollywood someday. These are all new rules of war. So war has moved on, and we must move on too. Victory in this new rules of war is an infinite game. There's not going to be a decisive USS Missouri moment like at the end of World War II where Japan surrenders. It's going to be more like business. You're not going to have, you know, Coke doesn't defeat Pepsi, obliterate them forever. You have better quarters, you have worse quarters. That's what war is turning into. And that's just actually normal for war. Most wars last a very long time. The Peloponnesian War lasted 30 years. The 30 Years' War, in many ways, World War II was the same war that lasted 30 years with a 20-year interim break. So how to win in this new environment of durable disorder? I give 10 new rules. They're broken down this way. They're all packed together a certain way. The first four rules are things we have to stop doing. The rules 5 through 10 are things we have to start doing. The U.S. is struggling because we are paradigm prisoners of our way of warfare. And it's not just the United States, it's the West. And if you think about it, what does it mean if the West has forgotten to win wars? The implications are terrifying, especially as we seem to be in the age of the autocrat and the rising autocracy. So this book is meant to generate a discussion, what I call an intellectual insurgency, and it's getting a lot of attention within Washington, D.C. circles in a very controversial but constructive way. Now with this, I'd like to turn it over and answer questions you might have about the new rules of war. Thank you very much.
What is the future of war? Do corporations, mercenaries, and rogue states now hold more power than nation states? The audience has more difficult questions for Sean McFate, like how is war being defined and how do conventional wars differ from other forms of war?
All data sets have problems, which I don't want to go into right now. It's not a perfect data set. It might be the best we have. They determine a war by 1,000 people or more dying in a war in a year. What counts as a war is always up in the air. So, for example, they don't count the Rwandan genocide, or they bracket it. And this is an interesting thing about new rules versus old rules of war. If you talk to a traditional warrior and you say, what was the Rwandan genocide? They say, well, it's not war. And I'm like, well, is it an 800,000 person homicide? What is it? Or you look at cartel wars in Mexico. To policymakers, that's a law enforcement problem. It's a police problem. But you can make the argument those are cartels waging wars without states, which is actually one of my rules, is wars without states is going to be a thing of the future. Last year, IISS, a think tank in London, put out its annual conflict survey. The most conflict deaths last year were, number one, Syria, not a surprise. Number two, not Iraq, not Afghanistan. Number two is Mexico. But what counts as war, I'm arguing, we should be more supple in our thinking about that, to include drug wars, to include things like genocide. To make this chart, you have to have at least 1,000 combat deaths, and how that's measured is another question. 1,000 combat deaths a year in a conflict. Everything else is insurgencies, it's terrorism, it's narco trafficking, it's stuff like that.
But how do you convince the Pentagon, the government officials, to actually listen to you?
So it's interesting. So I've had a lot of discussions within the Department of Defense, the State Department, others, and there's actually a lot of consensus around this, especially from vets coming back from war, because they see this. Where there is pushback is among certain senior service chiefs, obviously Lockheed Martin. One of the questions is like military-industrial complex, which I'm sure somebody might ask me about. But where I'm trying to really, and I've been told I need to focus on, is the Hill. Because the Pentagon, I've talked to people, the J staff, OSD policy, and they're like, we can only do what the Hill tells us to do. And that's where you really need to talk to. So there's actually, the military is quite receptive to this, more than some people will be, you know, surprised. And also, people ask me, like, well, one of the things I think we should do is slash the defense budget, because most of the defense budget goes to, like, very expensive conventional war weapons, and we should take that, and it'll make the Department of Defense much more cunning, because they'll have to do more with less. And also redistribute to like State Department and others that have been withering for 20 plus years that need to be resuscitated.
Thank you. This was a bombshell. There's one area that I don't believe you've gone into yet, and that's cyber security, because that's cheap, relatively. And it calls upon new technology, and it can do some very insidious things. The other area you just mentioned, the autocrats, because the world is no longer made up of major, major powers, whatever. There are a lot of leaders in various countries who have taken over everything. And even to look at North Korea, everything goes for nuclear warfare, whatever it is. What happens to the people? We see it more and more in Eastern Europe, many places. So this is a new world also.
It is. So those are two tough questions. So I do talk about cyber in rule number two. So when people think about cyber, there's a couple things to think about. There's a lot of jazz hands around cyber right now, right? So if you want to make a lot of money and you go to the Pentagon and say, you put cyber in front of whatever you're doing, cyber Carnegie Council, boom, money falls in your hands, right? That's not a development strategy. It's getting a lot of attention. And a lot of it is misbegotten because it's really influenced by things like Hollywood. People look at the movie Skyfall by James Bond. Anytime a hacker touches a keyboard, they become a god. Now, that's not the way cyber works. Or people say that it's Stuxnet. This was the virus, Israeli-American virus that, you know, we shot against in 2010 or 11 against Iran's nuclear program. In reality, Stuxnet had almost no effect on Iran's nuclear program. But cyber has a role to play. Its true power is not sabotage, which is how it's depicted often. It's influence. It's like Russia influencing elections and outcomes. And tying this to your second question, democracies, open societies are vulnerable to this type of manipulation. All right? And now it's easy to be morose about this, but autocrats are also vulnerable. And rule number nine, I talk about something called shadow war, which we can discuss a bit later. But we are vulnerable to this new way of war as others try to influence us, try to manipulate us with false knowledge, false information. There are strategies, in some ways, autocracies are easier to destabilize because they centralize everything in a certain elite class. And if you can get inside that and create paranoia, the autocrat will take care of, will purge of themselves. And I talk about some of these strategies in rule number nine, and I'll just put this out there for a later question, is like the question of ethics and also the question of secrets and democracy not being compatible. War is getting more sneaky. It's going into the shadows, but we've all learned from Senator Church that secrets and democracy are not compatible. So what do we do?
James Starkman. It's about cybersecurity. Would the Israelis be building a $1 billion or more project in the Negev almost completely devoted to cybersecurity if it were something other than what it is generally thought to be? Also, could we not take down the electrical grid of a potential enemy?
Yeah.
Or other sabotage, which I think you sort of diminished as a threat.
Yeah. So I had the privilege of spending 3 months in Israel last year working with as a visiting scholar at the IDF's War College. And they have a new strategy, defense strategy, military strategy out now, 2015, that kind of looks a lot like the new rules of war. They have something called the Campaign Between Wars, which looks a lot like shadow war, because Iran is waging a shadow war right now against Israel. Now, yes, but I don't think it's sabotage. I think it's influence. And it's also collection intelligence monitoring, like NSA type stuff. So for example, who's the Quds commander, I can't pronounce it. It was his birthday the other day, and Israel, and sort of new rules of war, ridicules a very powerful weapon that we don't do. It can go, it's like fire. It could power a steam engine, it could blow up the whole barn. They send out like this fake Facebook thing congratulating Soleimani on his birthday, and it has like Nasrallah from Hezbollah saying "way to go," and has all these other things getting "way to go." I think that's the true power of its influence. It's the ability to change people's minds, to shape the narrative of the conflict, to shape political perceptions, reality things, and disinformation. Now, power grids, people always say, they could take down our power grid. And people have been saying that for 25 years. In 2015 or 16, the Department of Energy said, and we're imminently likely to be hacked, and this is going to happen to America. Nothing ever happened. In fact, there is solid social study research to show that squirrels are a bigger threat to power grids than cyber. Squirrels. So rodent warfare. But in all seriousness, people say this, but I would love to see, I'm a cyber skeptic, I would love to see the math on it. I'd like to see how it works. Are we not resilient anymore after 20 years of this? Maybe we are, maybe we're not, but it's a threat, but I'm skeptical, that's all. You're an optimist, and that's okay too.
What are the chances of reviving real non-proliferation policy in this country? How are you yourself going to progress with, what do you do next for you to continue this?
The next 20 rules of war? Is that your? So when you say non-proliferation, I assume you mean nuclear.
Correct.
There's a couple things I do not touch in this book. And one of them is nukes. And I don't touch it because it's an important issue. I just ran out of space. And I do say this, is that why do we assume the nuclear taboo will last forever? Probably won't. And what does limited nuclear war look like? Is that all possible? Because we have in our mind 1962, right? The Cuban Missile Crisis. But that may not be what it, you know. And if you look at where it might happen, it could be India, Pakistan. It could be, you know, eventually in the Middle East between Israel, Saudi, and Iran with a 1914 scenario of a moment. But if there's a limited nuclear war, a nuclear war, I don't know what happened after that. It's a frightening thought. And people will look at this as big bombs. So I don't really know where that goes. My sense is the proliferation community is still in an old rules of war framework. They're still Westphalian in how they see the world. Now, where I would go, I don't really know what my next project is. One of the things that people have asked me about is that we desperately need a grand strategy for the 21st century, something that rationalizes American foreign policy, what America stands for in the world. Think of NSC 68 in 1950 or the Long Telegram. Containment was our grand strategy. Grand strategy is the rudder that guides a ship of state in international waters. We don't have that. We've been floundering for 25 years. So one of the things I'm thinking about is we need a book about what does grand strategy look like in an age of durable disorder. So that's a possibility, but I don't really have it. Still thinking.
My name is Jigar Khatri, and I wanted to ask you a question about hybrid warfare. I know you briefly touched on Russia and Ukraine. My question to you is, what can the United States and its allies do to, you know, defend against hybrid warfare, information warfare, and how can the U.S. and its allies establish deterrence in that domain?
So hybrid warfare, for those who don't know, this is a concept that was introduced in 2007 by a colonel in the Marine Corps, Frank Hoffman, who's a colleague and friend of mine at National Defense University. And since then, the idea is kind of, it's kind of blown up, so it kind of means a little bit of nothing, frankly. NATO has its version, but it's basically, it's something that looks a little bit like this. It's hybrid means it's conventional and unconventional war, ways of war mixed in together. And case studies would include Russia in the Crimea, Iran in Syria, things like that. The way I look at hybrid war is that it's an incredible leaping pad for conventional warriors to grasp this, the new rules of war. I think if you're at the operational art level of war, so war has three levels. Tactical is lowest, operational art is like campaigns, and strategic is what I'm talking about at the highest level. At the operational art level, it's useful for military defense planners because it can help them figure out how this is the type of war we're fighting and diagnosing it we need to do. But in terms of the strategic level, I don't believe in hybrid war. I think there's just war. There's no conventional war, unconventional war, or hybrid war. It's just war. I think deterrence doesn't work in this new set of wars because for deterrence to work, you have to have symmetry. It's like a game of chess that doesn't work in an age of non-attribution. So if war is becoming non-attribution, how can you deter? Think of it like the internet. How can you deter cyber hackers? You can't even tell where the cyber attack is usually coming from. So the logic of deterrence that worked in the Cold War does not work like it is here. I think we have to find other ways. Rather than deterring things, we have to get in the shadows and punch back.
My name's Peter Burgess. I'm interested in your views about some new rules for peace,
yes,
as opposed to war. Because
yes,
over the last 50 years, there have been some major progress in things like global education. Yet we've got leaders who basically are stuck in the 19th century, let alone the 20th century.
Yes.
And I'm just wondering whether you can apply some of your new rules to the issues of peace and people, like inequality, like the fact that you've got in development, you've worked to some extent in Africa.
Yes.
There are some amazing people in Africa.
Right.
But the leadership is, you know, in the kindergarten.
Right.
And very rich at it.
Yes, they're very good.
Your thoughts, sir?
Well, it's a great question. I agree with you. In some ways, I think the question of peace and war, you know, one's the opposite of the other. Sometimes you have to think of them as co-joined. And I think Africa, which I spent a great deal of time in, is benefiting from this. I think we have to start to pay attention also at demographic shifts, you know, education. But how do we do this in a way that is systemic in a global environment where international norms and international public law is fraying, in my opinion? Can the private sector, is there some intersection there that's beyond corporate social responsibility? CSR is often just a marketing line for some companies, right? Can we find ways to incentivize them to invest in communities because they need the community as so forth? So like one example, it's not a good example, but it might be like Firestone in Liberia. They created a village. They were farming rubber, and they created their own sort of parallel governance in that. There are some problems with that case study. I know that. I think that's a harder problem set for me. But I would love to explore that. And are there ways that we can find to blunt some of the worst effects? I mean, I'm not advocating war should be this. I'm observing wars becoming this way. So are there ways that we can blunt some of the worst aspects?
Yes, my name is Kellen Trinkle-Vermont. Thank you very much for a very interesting, insightful presentation.
Yeah.
I'm wondering, according to the new rules that you have outlined, what do you think would be an appropriate proportional response or retaliation against, for instance, the Russian government in response to what has been carried out against the values and ideals of this country? So what, according to these new rules, do you think is a proportional, adequate response? Because my sense is that the current response hasn't really been quite adequate to
yes,
shake up the Kremlin.
You're right. So when you use the word proportional, I think of just war theory. And I think just like the old rules are Westphalian and have to be updated, I think the laws of war also have to be updated to a new set of laws of war, the international law of armed conflict, whatever that looks like to you. So that's sort of a footnote, and that's maybe perhaps to the gentleman about the rules for peace. So if we can dispense for a second with proportionality and other just war theory ideas, I would say this, is that we can't just play defense. We have to play offense. We have to get in the shadows and punch. And if Russia is succeeding because they're using means of plausible deniability, then we have to create strategies of implausible deniability, okay? So that they can't hide behind it. Now, what they'll do is they'll litter the entire information landscape with BS. And so the signal-to-noise ratio is blocks everything out. We have to figure out, the answer to that is not try to find each one of those rumors and kill it. It's too late by then. The way we do is we have to get their mind off of the U.S. by getting their mind on internal stability and internal security. In the book, under rules, especially 9 and 10, I discuss what are some of the things that we could do. Now, we've done this before in the Cold War, I'm not saying we have to relive the Cold War, but we've done some of these things before. And I don't really have time right now, but there are certain things that we could do. Now, they will be controversial. They may be unethical, but they could also be effective. And that's a bigger question that any strategists have to ask. When you look at any strategy, there are at least two tests. One, is it feasible? And the second, is it acceptable? So I have feasible strategies, but I'm not sure if they would be acceptable, but I'm not sure if it's acceptable to have elections, you know, manipulated either.
I'm Reid Bonadon. I'm a senior fellow at the Carnegie Council. Military officers, generally, as you were alluding to, we get trained to think like tacticians. And one of the points I make in my book is that there may be some ways in which a lifetime of thinking like a tactician unsuits you to thinking at the strategic level.
Yeah.
They're very different kinds of thought. How do you think military education and military culture needs to change? Maybe some of the ways that you're changing the way that you teach, and I don't just mean inculcating the 10 rules, but changing the way military officers think to adapt to this new paradigm or model, whatever it is. I mean, one of the thoughts that I had is, I mean, for example, just war theory is pre-Westphalian. So,
yeah.
And when we had someone here talking about Thucydides, one of the things might be to go back to some of the earlier traditions of war fighting to get clues to this brave new world.
So actually, I spend a lot of time in this book talking about strategic education.
Okay.
Because in some ways, you could say, oh my gosh, this is so hard, but actually it's not. All we've got to do to win is change the way we think about war. It's not like we can't change our geopolitical circumstance. We can't add a few zeros to our national, you know, wealth or GDP. Those are all hard things to do. This is learning. And so I talk about something called, we need war artists, all right? War artists, so right now, here's what we do. If you're a military officer, you're a colonel, when a lieutenant colonel shows up to the war college, they've got about 15 to 20 years already in the service. Yeah. Why are we waiting 15 to 20 years before we start training strategic level education? Let's do it when people are freshmen, right? That's one thing. The second thing I do is that strategic level and tactical level thinking are different in this way. Tactical level thinking is like engineering. It's complicated thinking if systems theory. It takes a certain brilliance. Like to make a 747 takes billions of parts, a lot of knowledge, a lot of skill to do it. But you can solve it, you can create it, you can make it fly. At the strategic level, we only have wicked problems. It's all ambiguity, right? So engineering, which is what West Point teaches, is not good for ambiguity. What we need for strategic level thinking are the humanities, nice. Liberal arts, right? Because when you read Dostoevsky, you're not really learning about 19th century Russian society, you're thinking through ambiguity. And how do you think through ambiguity? So we need that. And the third thing we need is, why do we assume that the best strategists only have military uniforms, right? So let's open it up. Mercenaries change war in fundamental ways. They marketize it, right? So think of market strategies blending with military ones. Think of Adam Smith meets CrossFits. We have CEOs in this town that want to be better strategists than four stars in Washington, right? So let's open up our aperture for what makes a good strategist, and why don't we create an academy that's for that, or some sort of tracked in the Army or Marine Corps. Right now in the military, if you're tracked as a strategist, it's kind of a joke. It's kind of a career ender. Right? You probably were not that, but like there are people who are tracked as strategists, and they're stuck doing PowerPoint in the Pentagon for 5 years. And so we need to take it seriously. We need innovative ways of thinking.
Thank you for a thrilling and very informative presentation. My question will focus in on Rule 9, where shadow wars. I'm convinced by a lot of what you've said. I find it compelling. I guess my question would be, what would be the cost to our societies and our ways of thinking if we were to go deep into that shadow war area? Because
I mean,
in terms of the British government, we've got our full spectrum effects toolbox is much smaller than the Russian full spectrum effects toolbox. It's partly because we're a democracy and we can't move as fast. So they go into Crimea, they move at lightning speed, they go into Syria, take us by surprise, because they can, because they don't have to run it past the Duma. They can just do it. They can dispatch a hit squad into the UK and take someone out, although they say they were tourists visiting a cathedral, which is a compelling counter-narrative. But the point is, they can move fast, they can do things, and they're not, it's a gangster state as well. So they've got a gangster code. It's not like they have no rules. They have rules. But the way they operate, they don't think about ethics and these sorts of factors. So I guess my question is, how would you deal with that challenge? Because yes, we could deploy mercenaries. Yes, we could. Yeah, they've taken out one of ours. We could deploy special forces into Moscow. Well, I wouldn't do it, but we could. Okay. But then where does it go? How does it escalate?
There are things that we should consider doing. And, you know, let's find ways to disrupt the Russian chain of command so they don't know if it's a real order from the Kremlin or not to do something. And if they do something, they get whacked by the Kremlin, right? How do we create paranoia within the autarch's elite circle, because it's full of ambitious people, and let him take them down for us? Victory goes to the cunning and not the strong. And there's lots of other ideas in here. I mean, it's also ridicule and influence. I mean, Putin runs around half naked on a bear. Why can't we do something about that, right? I mean, seriously. So I think we're a little too cautious. Now, how does it end? This is a good question, but there's also non-action is also an outcome, right? I mean, do we want our kids to be, or grandkids to be speaking Mandarin and Russian? I don't know. But you raise an important point, like the laws of armed conflict. It's an, you know, secret to democracy. It's an important question. I don't have the answers in this book, but I'm intellectually honest about flagging it, saying, boom, somebody smarter than me needs to think about this. But I do think we have to be aware that the status quo is not working.
My name is Charles Liebling. I noticed in the 10 rules, there's no mention of international law. There's no mention of Geneva Conventions. There's no mention of United Nations. When you say conventional war is dead, are you saying that international law is dead, that the Geneva Conventions don't mean anything anymore?
This book does not cover the ethics of war. It brackets it. Ethics are a very important thing of war, but that's not what this book does. This book is in the tradition of Clausewitz and Sun Tzu. It assumes once legitimate authority has decided to go to war, it's about how to wage war as efficiently as possible to minimize suffering. Second of all, I do think that international public law, international organizations are largely relics of a Westphalian era. And they have proven incapable in 25 years, from NATO in the Balkans to, and I did several chapter 6 and 7 missions in Africa, working alongside the United Nations. I came away from there kind of pessimistic. You can look at what, you know, where has the UN been in Syria and Iraq, right? They need to update just like this. I'm trying to pull the national security establishment into the 21st century. I think one gentleman said the 19th century. I think it's a fair rendition. I think in some ways, the rules of modern diplomacy and international law are mired also in the 19th century. And they also tend to be very tactical and not strategic. So I think there needs to be a similar treatment for international public law as this, but the, you know, different audience. So I'm not the person to do that. I have enough knowledge to get in trouble, but not out of it.
Professor of Strategy, Sean McFate. You can find details of his book, New Rules of War, Victory in the Age of Durable Disorder, on our Big Ideas website. He was speaking at the Carnegie Council for Ethics in International Affairs, who kindly provided this recording for us. That's it for this Big Ideas. Thanks for listening. I'm Paul Barclay. Bye for now.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.